Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to Movie Geeks United, another great episode of Movie Geeks United tonight. Some great movie talk, some great information we're going to convey to you tonight as well about the art of filmmaking. It's going to be an exciting night. My name is Jamie, and I have Jerry here with me too. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I ruined your big intro, man. I'm
sorry.
Jumped
the gun. That's all right. No, we're happy to have everyone here tonight. We've got an awesome show for you, so stick around.
Yeah. It should be a lot of fun. We're going to be talking about green screening. Which is something that we haven't covered on the show, and it's fascinating if you talk about an area of filmmaking that has really advanced, in recent years. That's what you're talking about, green screen technology. Mm-hmm. It's part of that. And then we'll be joined later by fellow movie geek Chris, and we'll do some informative, fun roundtable discussions on the latest movie topics and news. So how are you, Jerry?
I'm doing okay. It's raining around us. We've had it's all this rainy, cold week here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing to write home about.
Yeah. It's been. Why would you write home? You're actually at home.
Okay. Yes.
But
thank you.
There's been bad weather all over the place. Lately.
Yeah. It's not good. It's not good.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Isn't that what the stellar way to start the show?
I think everyone's tuned out already.
I think they've all left. They're all going to watch whatever the show is on after Lost.
Yes. To let everyone know, we have James Toback on Sunday's show, a great guest. If you've read recent interviews with James Toback concerning his new documentary, Tyson, you know that he is a fascinating, very intelligent, very kind of – every interview feels like a confessional with James Toback.
Oh, it is.
He's brutally honest.
Yeah, I just read David Thompson's biographical sketch of him in his Biographical Dictionary of Film, which is essentially literally a love letter to James Toback about their friendship or whatever, and really a rave about the movie Fingers. But there's also a great documentary I saw a year ago on James Toback, which was the making of his latest movie before Tyson, the one with, I believe it's Neve Campbell.
When Will I Be Loved?
Yeah, and that's he's a fascinating individual.
Very much.
And the thing with Tyson is actually, you could say, foreshadowed in that movie he made a couple cuts with 2000, Black and White, because Tyson has a cameo in that. So, fascinating individual. Just a great screenwriter, great director. I mean, this is a real privilege to be able to interview this man.
Yeah, Jimmy Toback, so that's Sunday night. Let's get to our first guest. Let me tell you a little bit about what we'll be discussing in this segment. Green screen technology, of course, has taken over mainstream features. That's nothing new. But now there are amazing tools available to filmmakers and videographers across the spectrum. But with great power comes great responsibility. It is a tricky art.
Thanks, Uncle Ben.
Thank you. It's a tricky art. But if you want to know how you can improve upon your green screen technique, you can't do better than the new book, Green Screen Made Easy, Keying and Compositing Techniques for Indie Filmmakers by Jeremy Haneke, See, I'm already massacring names. And Michelle Yamazaki. Michelle is the VP of Marketing and a Web Development Czarina for ToolFarm.com, and she's demoed plugins for Apple, and Boris FX, and Red Giant, and other great companies. So it is a real pleasure to welcome her on our show, Movie Geeks United. Please welcome Michelle Yamazaki. Let me bring her line up. Michelle,
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for being on, of course. This is a fascinating to me, this book, because are there, in your experience, are there other books on green screen that are written for the layperson, so to speak, without all the geek speak in it?
I haven't come across one, and that was why we chose to write it in this way, to low-budget filmmakers and students and hobbyists.
Yes, of course. And tell me how you got involved in the technological side of videography and filmmaking.
Well, I went to school for editing, and I have my major was communications with an emphasis in video editing, and I ended up getting a job at Postworks, and I was a motion graphics designer there. We did a little bit of green screen, but not a ton. I mostly did moving titles and that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, graphic builds, a lot of corporate video where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So I ended up leaving in 2005 and took this job at Tool Farm. I started a site with, it was maybe 2001 called AE Freemart. It's all Adobe After Effects,
mm-hmm.
free
mm-hmm.
stuff, tutorials mm-hmm. and plugins
right.
and that kind of thing. And Tool Farm had contacted me about the site and said, hey, we want to buy you and stuff. So I ended up working for them, being hired, and it's been great. I love it. But since I've been working for them, you know, I have all of these plugins now at my disposal. Before, it was really difficult to get these plugins because a lot of them are expensive. And also, it's really evolved in the last 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm.
These plugins didn't exist back then.
Right.
So,
You actually brought up something. We'll jump around a little bit here with After Effects and that sort of thing. I'm just trying to learn After Effects CS4, and I'm using Premiere Pro as well. Which do you prefer? Do you prefer Premiere Pro? Do you prefer Final Cut? Is that a battle? Is one improved over the other?
Well, I prefer Premiere. I know I'm a Mac user, and the majority of the Mac users use Final Cut.
Mm-hmm.
But, you
mm-hmm.
know, I'm working on a laptop most of the time, and
right.
I just don't have the space for both.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Since I'm using all of the Adobe Suite anyway, it just made sense. And they're very similar. So
uh-huh.
as far as, you know, how they work, I mean, mm-hmm. you can jump in, you can go back and forth pretty easily.
Yeah. So let's start from the beginning. Tell me... what is green screen?
It is a technology that, well, the green screen is just a green wall, basically,
mm-hmm.
or a green backdrop of some sort.
Right.
And they choose green because it's not a color found in human skin tone, so it's easier to isolate that area when you're
mm-hmm.
wanting to pull a key.
Right.
So that's why green is so commonly used. Blue has been used in the past as well.
Right.
You know, green works very well for video, for DV, just because of how, I'm not really a technical person, and we don't go into this really heavily, but the way that green breaks down a lot of the spectrum, or I don't even know what you call it accurately,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of video is green, so
yeah.
you have a much larger area, it's easier to pull. That was a horrible, horrible description.
No, that's fine. No, nothing wrong there.
We want this to be green screen 101 because
yeah.
to start us off with baby steps. So essentially, you place someone in front of a green screen and you can key out the background and put them in any environment you wish.
Yeah, that's the theory. That's how it works. But there's so many small things that you have to look out for that it's easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lighting has to be right. If you overlight your actor or your background, or, you know, you get a lot of spill on your actor. There's a lot of things. Spill would just be reflected green on your actor.
Like they have a green halo around the edges of their body, yeah, right?
Right, or mm-hmm. say that they're wearing something white, or
mm-hmm.
their face picks up green and they are green tinged.
Sure.
That kind of thing, so.
Yeah, and what are some...
a lot of gotchas.
Yeah, what are some of those common mistakes that filmmakers have while they're trying to work green screen?
Well, lighting is a huge issue. If you don't have it lit correctly, correctly or your actor is too close to your green screen, you just need to space everything out. We have diagrams in the book that describe how to light your actor properly and how far away the camera should be from your actor, how far the actor should be away from the green screen.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. Improper lighting, I would say, is the biggest thing in shooting. If you have it too dark, you're going to have really noisy footage.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very difficult to deal with. You know, you boost it up. It's garbage in, garbage out, basically.
Right,
you don't
right.
Have, you can fix some things in post, but not everything.
Well, that's just it. And this is something that you detail in the book as well, that you can't rely on fixing everything in post. And I think a lot of times what trips videographers up is their impatience.
Yeah.
That's a big thing because it takes a lot of tinkering. And like you say, you're not going to get it right the first time. There is no perfect key.
No, there certainly isn't. There's other things you need to look for, too. You know, matching your foreground and background plates, the angle. The foreground plate would be your green screen footage, and the background plate would be whatever you're putting behind. Mm-hmm. Say you're putting your actor in a city scene of, I don't know, Buenos Aires, and you have stock footage, you know, because you can't get there, and the light angle is completely wrong or the camera angle is completely wrong. It's going to be a dead giveaway.
Right.
That the footage mm-hmm. is wrong. The coloring, you can fix the coloring in post pretty easily, but light angle is pretty much impossible to fix.
Mm-hmm.
So
and
that's
since
the type of thing you need to have ready beforehand. Get your background elements together before you start shooting. And I don't know a lot of people that do that.
Yeah, yeah. It takes a lot of work.
Yeah, there's a lot of, not a lot, but you do see stuff where the lighting and stuff like that is horrible. Like in a lot of like really low budget, like stuff on the Sci-Fi Channel, their original movies or something, they don't look exactly
right.
Great.
Tell me how this technology has evolved over the years, because like we've mentioned, it goes beyond feature films now. You talked about corporate videos. It's used in such a variety of applications. So since you've been involved in it, how have you witnessed its evolution?
Well, the tiers have gotten so much better. And, for example, you know, that it used to be, well, After Effects has pretty much always had one included called the color difference tier,
mm-hmm.
which is all right. But until Keylight came along and is now included in After Effects, everybody has that who buys
mm-hmm.
After Effects now. And it's such a better tier. It's just works so much nicer. It's easier to get a clean edge.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the tiers, too, now have other features like light wrap and spill suppression and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the prices have come down. I've worked with some hardware tiers before, and they're pretty impressive, you know, but you're going to drop a whole lot of money on those. So.
Right,
yeah,
right.
That's true.
But something I was encouraged by in your section of the book is your emphasis on story. So do you find that people have a tendency to overuse this technology?
I think they can overuse it. You know, it's easy enough to just keep it simple, but people want to show off all their cool plugins and that kind of thing. So you do see some overuse of it.
Yeah.
We always say, you know, make sure you storyboard everything out. Don't depend too heavily on the effects to make your project look good.
Mm-hmm.
You really need a story, though. So.
Yeah, a story.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, of
no
course,
matter what.
About that. Yeah.
George Lucas could have read your book when he prepared the
prequels.
Previous Star Wars.
Oh.
Yeah. So tell me about the book first of all. This is interesting because you co-author with Jeremy Henke. How did that work? And you guys kind of split the book in half. You have the latter half. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, he contacted me a few years ago from Micro Filmmaker, which is an online magazine, and he had contacted me at Tool Farm about acquiring products for review and that kind of thing. So we
mm-hmm.
knew each other then, and he mainly works in production, does the shooting and that end of it, and he knew that I worked with a lot of plugins and knew the post end of it. So he had actually talked to the publishers of the book first, and then he contacted me to see if I would help him out with the second half of the book, the
mm-hmm.
post-production. So that's how that all came about.
Yeah. And tell me what, obviously they can purchase your book. They can purchase your book actually from our website. If they click on the front cover icon, it'll take them directly to the Amazon page where they can purchase it as they listen to the show. But what other tools and tutorials? I know you have web tutorials as well. Can you point us in that direction as well for our listeners?
Sure. Actually, just yesterday, a tutorial that I did for Red Giant TV came out. It
mm-hmm.
focuses on Primat Keyer Pro and KeyCorrect Pro.
Okay.
And there's one I recently did for Boris Effects as well. It's about their 3D plugins, not green screen.
Could you tell me a little bit more about those programs? If someone is investigating programs and they're starting from scratch, what are the essentials?
For keying, you'd need a keyer, first off. You probably want to – it depends on your host application. If you're using After Effects, say, I would recommend Keylight, which is included with After Effects, or Primat Keyer Pro from Red Giant Software. It's very easy to use, and it's very intuitive. It's not one of those that you end up fuddling with the switches a lot, you know, that kind of thing, where you have to be some sort of a rocket scientist to figure out what the numbers mean. It has big buttons, and you drag your mouse around the green part or around your mat, so it's very easy to use.
Okay.
I really like that one. It comes with a light wrap and all that included. And a
okay.
light wrap, what that is, that will bring in some reflection of your background into the edges of your foreground or your green screen person to blend them more, to blend them better into the background to make them more natural looking with the background.
Right.
So that's a really nice tool because it has everything.
Okay.
Those are my two favorites. I don't recommend keying in Final Cut. It's just difficult. The masking tools in Final Cut, ugh. <Don't> like there's some third-party plugins that you can get that will help with the masking. There's one from CHV Plugins for Final
uh-huh.
Cut Pro that the name of it slips my mind at the moment, but it's an effects script plugin.
Okay.
And but I just don't like keying in Final Cut Pro and don't do it.
What is the new? I heard something today. We're talking about green screen today. There's a new Apple application. It's something that no kids can buy, and it has green screen capability.
I haven't heard anything about it.
What is their new product? It's iSomething.
It would be iSomething, but there's so many new. I'm trying to think. Now, when you say kids can use it, are they using it in schools or?
Well, I say kid. I mean, you can be 25, and I can call you a kid.
Oh,
but,
great!
But,
all right, we're getting on the age game here. We do a lot of Apple videos for their website at my work. I'm just trying to think if I've seen anything aimed at like that with green screens, and I can't say I have.
Is it a plug-in for iMovie or something?
iMovie, that's it, yeah. Yeah. I just bring that up because it's amazing that these kinds of technologies are in the hands of so many people now, and if you think back to Spielbergs and the directors, when they are growing up, they didn't have these kinds of tools at their disposal. And now teens and young adults do.
Everyone has this at their
end. Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that a positive, Michelle?
Oh, absolutely. When I was in high school, this is totally going to age me here, but we didn't have any of that kind of thing. I mean, the AV
No,
club,
we didn't.
They didn't really do any of that. Then, you know, I got into college, and we were editing on SVHS back and forth. It was
Oh, I remember
terrible.
That, yeah.
A few years ago, or a few years after I graduated, they end up getting all this nonlinear stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
And, I taught at college. I taught After Effects there. I mean, things have changed so much since I got out of college. And, I mean, I'm not that old.
No, we weren't implying.
We're all in the same boat here.
No,
okay.
I know you didn't say anything. But, the kids are so much smarter to it, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah,
from when
they're
I went to college.
So much more sophisticated about movies now. And, Michelle, thank you so much. The book is called Green Screen Made Easy, King and Compositing Techniques for Indie Filmmakers. It's on bookshelves now, and you can purchase it here from our homepage as well. Michelle, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Have a great evening.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Have
a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we talk green screen.
It's a good thing Liam Neeson didn't call in. He had so much fun making The Phantom Menace. He said he'd never do that again.
Yeah, no more green screen. That's another thing. It has changed acting as well. I mean, it has really placed another level of demands on the actor.
And it's funny, you know, he said that then, but of course he comes back, you know, and does the voice of the Lion in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movies. I mean, he's been on a lot of things, a lot of special effects extravaganza since then. But I just think that whole experience in the first one really did leave him, because he had never done that before, and he was really, I think, just puzzled, if not disgusted, with the whole process.
And in honor of Michelle's appearance on the show, I have been doing this interview to a stick and a tennis ball. So, there you go.
There you go, folks.
That's Chris's line. Chris gave me that line earlier. I had to steal it from him.
Okay.
Speaking of Chris, he's right here. Hang on. Hey, buddy.
What's up, baby doll?
Baby doll. Hi, Chris.
What's going on, Jared? That was to you. That was to both of you. I should have said baby dolls.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's very flattering.
How dare you leave me out?
The line sounds great tonight.
I know.
What's up with that?
I have no idea.
We better make sure it's a good show. We have phone reception.
Absolutely.
So, Chris, you actually, tell me whatever possessed you to go ahead and watch Wolverine.
Well, basically, I had been talking shit about the movie for a month now.
And you wanted to put your money where your mouth was?
Yeah, and I kind of started to feel like a hypocrite because I kept getting, well, you didn't even see it, thrown back in my face. Those people that said that were right. I hadn't seen it. So I wanted to see it, and I wanted to see it so that I could talk about the movie and not have that thrown back in my face. And I knew that I needed to watch it with an open mind, so I absolutely did that. When I sat down to watch it, I said, okay, throw everything you think out the window and just watch the movie and give it a fair shot. So that's what possessed me.
Okay, were you able to do that? Because I find sometimes it's hard with some of these movies with such the negative reception going in. You try, but you know there's always that thing, the negativity does seep in while you're watching it.
Yeah, I could understand if it was a movie like that's true, I think you're right. Like when I finally sat down to watch Ghost Rider, for instance, like it was just, but with the X-Men movie, or with the Wolverine movie, I should say, it's a little bit different because I do like the first two X-Men movies.
Yeah.
So I got a little something I can hang on to there when I sat down to watch it. That's what I sort of told myself when I sat down to watch the Wolverine movie. I said, well, I like the first two X-Men movies. I didn't like the third one, but let's give it a shot. You know, Gavin Hood is, you know, not a nobody. He's done two decent movies. He's not the Rat. I like Hugh Jackman. I like Leave.
The Rat. I've never heard that before. That's classic.
I like Hugh Jackman a lot as an actor and as a guy. I like Liev Schreiber. I loved me some Danny Houston. I like Ryan Reynolds. So there was some stuff for me to grab onto when I sat down and watched the movie.
As opposed to Ghost Rider, where there's nothing to hold on to.
As opposed to Ghost Rider. That was just an example, a top of my head, of a similar movie that I went into with negative ideas.
Okay. But, so is it better than Ghost Rider, in your opinion?
No. That said, 5 minutes into the movie, I mean, I was just literally just, like, snorting out loud at the screen and, like, just, oh, come on. Like, it's...
Your generosity and open mind only go so far.
Yeah, really, really. Well, you got to 5 minutes, so you got through the credits at least.
No, the credits were not rolling yet when I was
finished. Oh, shit.
Well, you know, it's one of these movies that's got the opening scene before the credits hit, you know. So
was there like a typo in the opening credits?
Yeah,
what turned you off?
They spelled Hugh Jackman's name wrong.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous from the beginning. What it reminded me of after I watched it, and it's unfortunate the timing of Wolverine, because it is the next big superhero movie to come out after last year, which was a pretty good year for superhero movies. Now, I didn't care much for The Hulk or for Hellboy 2, but a lot of people did. But, of course, we had The Dark Knight, which is arguably, I don't even think you could argue, it's probably the best superhero movie ever made. Of course, Iron Man also, not quite on the Dark Knight level, but the Iron Man proves you don't have to be Dark Knight. You don't have to be,
yeah,
you know, one of the greatest action movies ever made to make a really good superhero movie. You know, if Dark Knight's a 10, Iron Man's a 9. I mean, it's a really good movie.
Last year
proved that a superhero movie could be done and done well. Now, Wolverine, the timing is unfortunate for Wolverine because it's coming on the heels of those two movies. And what it reminded me of after I walked out of it, because it's so ridiculous, it's just so bad, you know, everything from the script, which is just nonsense with all these lines. Wolverine gives lines like, "You wanted the animal? You got him." Like, all these awful lines, and the story makes no sense whatsoever. They shoehorn all these other characters like Gambit and Blob in there.
They give everyone the short stick. I mean, they shove it in there.
Everyone gets the short stick. And what you said about the movie last week, Jerry, is absolutely right. It just wasn't necessary. What they made with and if it was necessary, they didn't do a good job of convincing me that it was necessary. And what it reminded me of was, remember in the late 80s when, like, hair rock like Poison and Def Leppard and all those bands that were popular. And then all of a sudden in 90 or 91 or whatever it was, Nirvana came out with Smells Like Teen Spirit and the Nevermind album.
Right.
And that just completely changed what happened with rock music.
Right.
But it's not like Poison and Def Leppard and Motley Crue stopped making albums. They still shat out a couple albums after Nevermind, and they were
on nostalgia tours.
They were a joke by that point, because everybody's like, wait, the tide has turned here. We're into this new thing. Like, we've seen that rock music can be relevant now. Why do I want to listen to Girls, Girls, Girls by Poison or whatever the fuck they were making?
No,
that's
Motley Crue, but I know what you're saying. It's cosmic. That's what it seems.
Jerry
like
knows all the hair bands.
After having seen Dark Knight and Iron Man, this movie just seems so ridiculous. It's poorly made.
Ask you this, don't you feel we got this story, though, in that little bit of backstory in X-Men 2?
Absolutely.
I mean,
that's a really good point. They didn't, they took what they did in X-Men 2 was give you what you needed to know.
Because first of all, this storyline of Origins was very controversial when they first published it, his Origins. This didn't go over well with fans. This was a really big black mark against, reveal all this stuff, and people are like, it's not, we didn't need to know this. It goes to that thing where it's just backstory, and backstory is fine, but there's a reason it's called backstory.
Right.
You know, and it's done, and, like, the second one, I think it's done very well. This one, you know, there's some interesting things, but not enough to really, you know, justify, I think, a full movie. The sad thing is, it makes me respect the third one a lot more.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because the third one's been on TV a lot lately, and after I saw Wolverine, I watched a little bit of it, and I was like, you know what? After Wolverine, like, this is not that bad. X3 is actually it's a little bit more coherent to film. It's not made very well because it is the rat, but it makes sense. It's got a decent script. It's just a little bit cheesy, and there's a little bit too many characters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the disaster that Wolverine is. Wolverine it is in a category with movies like Daredevil and Ghost Rider and things like that that are just preposterous. No sense.
Something happened. Iron Man is really, I think, really the pinnacle of the Marvel movies, the Marvel-based movies, but they got on this high horse starting, and I like The Hulk. I don't think The Hulk's great. I mean, it's a shame it comes after Iron Man because it just pales in comparison for the most part, but they are going through this thing where they have this very ambitious schedule. They're trying to cram all this stuff, and I'm afraid that they're going to just, like, overkill everything. I'm also afraid they're going to ruin Iron Man 2, to be very honest with you. I have some fears about that.
Yeah, no, I understand. I agree with you. It's too much, and we're into sort of second-tier characters and things like that. And frankly, you know, not to nerd out too much with the comic books, but the Wolverine comic was never a great comic book. X-Men was a great comic book, you know, all throughout the...
He worked better in that context of the other characters and how he relates to those characters, I think.
Right. He always worked better in and among the X-Men. He's just not... He's just a little bit too brooding and a little bit... It's just, you know, I mean, you kind of get it. You didn't have to... Like you said, you didn't have to see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You could take the little piece they gave you in X2 and you could sort of do the math.
Yeah.
Like, he was working for Stryker. They screwed him over. He didn't like some of the stuff they were doing. He went rogue, and now he's on his own. You know, like, I mean, that, and that's basically the movie. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's what happened.
That, yeah, that is.
Well, even so, that being said, they've already signed up for the another spinoff.
Yeah.
So
another Wolverine movie?
No, it's a spinoff. It's another X-Men character, isn't it?
Yeah, they're doing two
yeah.
more. It's like, it's a, you know, I think Magneto's the next one. So.
Right, but after Origins did so well, just a day ago, I think, they announced that they're going to do a Deadpool movie, which is the Ryan Reynolds character. And the Ryan Reynolds, Ryan Reynolds is a good actor. I think he gets a bad rap, and I know you do too, Jamie. He's actually very funny in Wolverine, but he doesn't fit. He belongs in another movie. He doesn't...
Well,
quite.
It does have good actors in it. Wolverine
does.
Lee Schreiber is accomplished... But he's not accomplished in the way that you'd expect to see him in a Wolverine movie.
No, although I will say that Liev Schreiber, all those actors do the best with what they're given. I mean, Danny Houston is still Danny Houston. Liev Schreiber is still Liev Schreiber. In fact, Liev Schreiber, he should get better parts because this movie proves that he can do, he makes quite a good villain, actually. It's unfortunate it's in this movie.
The shame is it's actually written by a very accomplished novelist and screenwriter, David Benioff. Who did The 25th Hour. And I mean, you got to wonder, like, you know, for such an accomplished writer, I mean, I know he's not the only writer, but you got to wonder, I mean, what, you know, this is the best you can do. I mean,
25th Hour is a movie that I revisit every year.
Yeah, it's a great book, great movie. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
And you wonder,
if you had not reminded me of that he was the same guy that wrote those two movies, I never would have guessed that. I mean, I easily would have guessed that this was a first time writer. Or, you know, maybe
Uwe Boll.
Yeah, maybe you Uwe Boll wrote it or somebody like that. It's that bad. It really is that bad. And frankly, I think that there have been some people, like I've been hearing, you know, not necessarily people that I know, saying, you know, I thought it was okay. And you know what? Like, I'm sorry. Like, if you like this movie, I fear you may have a learning disability.
I've talked to some people who are comic fans who don't love it. I mean, they have problems with it, but it's not as bad as they thought it would be. And that I can understand because they're coming from a different vantage point.
Right. Yeah, I can understand that too. But again, if you walk out of a movie and the best thing you can say is, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Are you going to remember it in 2 years? Is that going to get better through time, or is that going to get worse through time?
It makes me really want to go see Next Day Air even more. You know.
Well, in terms of trends, we don't have the trend of so many superhero movies this year as we did last year. But let's talk about another trend. Let's talk about sequels. Not sequels, remakes, whether they are necessary or why not. For instance, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
You know, Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 is one of those movies that people our age, people my age, your age, Jerry's age, you know, we know that movie.
Yeah.
But the younger generation and even maybe some people in my age group, they're not that familiar with that movie.
Right.
And that's not a classic. It's a really good movie, but it's not a classic. I can see wanting to take that story and sort of maybe update it. But what the problem I have is why not just take that idea of Pelham 1-2-3 and sort of update it the way they did with Disturbia. That's essentially Rear Window. And they took that nugget of an idea and made a movie that exists, that still you can say, yeah, it's influenced by Rear Window, but it sort of exists on its own, and it's a pretty good movie. Why not do that with Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, you know?
I agree. I agree with you. It just reminds me kind of almost of Speed at this point, even though, I mean, but it does have that feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
just make something else and don't call it Pelham 1-2-3. I mean, we all know that there's not that much that's original these days. I mean, if there really aren't that many, you know, we've all heard there's only 10 screenplays in Hollywood
right.
or whatever the old saying is, you know. And then there's Charlie Kaufman screenplays. So.
But it brings up an interesting point. It goes to, I'm thinking too of Rod Laurie, because when we spoke to Rod Laurie and he gave his take on Straw Dogs, which he's currently casting, he said, look, it's not the most revered Peckinpah film. I don't know how many people outside of aficionados like us remember the film. And it's a completely different take, which begs the idea, which begs the question, why are you naming it Straw Dogs? You
know? I agree with that. It's like the thing with the Wild Bunch. There was talk of remaking the Wild Bunch a couple of years ago.
Right.
It's going to be, but it was going to take place today, and it was going to involve drug dealers in Mexico.
Yeah. Why not just call it Traffic?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's I don't have the problem with remakes I once did.
Right.
Instead of, why not just clean up a print of Straw Dogs, restore it?
You know what, I do have a problem with remakes like this one. Bonnie and Clyde starring Hilary Duff.
Well, that I have a lot of problems with. Like I said, just to make a new print and re-release it.
Right. Okay, let me take a phone caller real quick, and then we'll get back on this. 260 area code, I think this is Indiana. 260, are you there?
Yes.
Hey, buddy, what's your name?
My name's Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Hey. I was going to have my radio show tonight, and I heard you guys were on talking about this, and I had touched some subjects on stuff like this before about remakes on my last show, and I thought I'd call in and kind of get my two cents on it.
Please do.
A big issue, I know, like with remakes, like turning shows, TV shows into movies.
Sure.
And stuff like that. I guess it's kind of like a remake, kind of a thing to talk about. But films like Starsky and Hutch, like with Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson, you know, where like the show was supposed to be a little, you know, obviously it was a little bit, it was corny, but it was supposed to be meant serious, and they turned
right.
it into a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And
or
I mean,
the Upcoming Land of the Lost.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the TV show things. I think they're harmless, they're innocuous, because they're most of them are just paper thin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just come and go. They're kind of disposable in a way. That just shows us, that kind of marks desperation.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at
they're mining name recognition.
Yeah, I mean, Sergeant Bilko, McHale's Navy, Car 54, Where Are You? They remade all these things in the movies, and that no one went to go see in the 90s.
Have any of them been good? Chris, do you think any of them have been good, the TV show films?
I think the Charlie's Angels movies were good, and in fact, I think the Charlie's Angels movies were better than the TV show. And actually, I honestly could make that argument for Starsky and Hutch, too, frankly, because most of those old TV shows aren't as good as we remember them. If you go back and watch them,
it's,
you know, we all
nostalgia, really.
Yeah, we all have fond memories of being a kid and watching Charlie's Angels or Starsky and Hutch. But if you go back, like, how many of us own the box sets of Starsky and Hutch or Charlie's Angels? They're not that good. You go back and watch them. So, yeah, I agree. They're paper thin for the most part. The worst case scenario, they're forgettable. Best case scenario, you get Charlie's Angels.
You just get a good laugh, like Starsky and Hutch watching Snoop Dogg as Huggy Bear. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You get something.
But I do think that there's primarily two motives for making a remake. You're either wanting to take something which is old and a new generation doesn't know about it, so you respect the artistic merit in the original product, so you want to bring it to new audiences. That's the first motive. The second motive is purely money, and that's what happens with things like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, and maybe a lot of these TV shows. But I don't think there's anything wrong if an artist really loves a piece of material and wants to update it for a future generation. In a way, that's kind of like what they do with plays, isn't it? I mean, if the first person that ever did, you know, Richard III or Hamlet or something like that, if the first production of that on the stage was great, Didn't it get met with that the next time someone tried to stage?
Yeah, but I mean, like what Kurosawa did with the Shakespeare and put it in medieval Japan. I mean, just
yeah. Or if you or if you think back onto the staging of a Streetcar when it was Brando's debut. It wasn't a debut. I think he did something like some cafe show, but he did this this incredibly earth-shattering performance in, on stage in Streetcar. They've done Streetcar since on stage and in film.
Yeah. and never as memorable as that one, but does that mean they should never do it again? I don't know. And, yeah, there's a difference between stage and film because not everyone got to enjoy that Brando stage performance.
Right.
Yeah, they're all dead now, so there are no memories of it, really, beyond the written word.
Yeah, that's right. There you go.
But I do think that you can apply that same sort of nugget of an idea to film and say Straw Dogs is a good movie. Maybe 4% of the population right now either saw it or remembers it. It's good enough that maybe we can update it. Will it work? Probably not. But I do think that there's nothing wrong with trying. If you really
trying at all, if it's Rod Laurie, who I think respects the source material enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think Rod Laurie strikes me as someone that doesn't make a movie unless he has something to say with it.
Yeah.
I think that's important. But you aren't going to say anything with Starsky and Hutch. What are you going to say? Like, it's possible for a horse to OD on coke? I mean, you know, isn't there a party horse scene in that movie or something?
Yeah.
I don't remember it that well, Jamie. I mean, did that horse have insurance?
I thought like a horse OD'd or something.
No, they shoot a horse in the garage, I think.
Oh, it must have been Snoop Dogg that OD'd. Okay, Tim, are there any remakes that are on your list of enjoyable films? Do you like any of them?
Well, a good example is the new RoboCop remake that they're getting ready to that Darren Aronofsky is getting ready to direct.
He's off that though, isn't he? I think
I read that. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm assuming. I guess they had some kind of confrontation, I guess, with the producer or something. But I would like him to. I guess I could trust him more than any other director to do it because, you know, he's got an artsy independent background to him, and I think he could. I think he would respect the original source material. Maybe he would do a good job at it, but. You know, that's that film, I mean, it's an 80s classic. It came out in, like, 1987, and...
It holds up very well.
Yeah, I don't think people will forget it.
No.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so
I think they should only remake bad movies and try to make them better, like remake Showgirls or something.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, nobody does that. They remake Psycho, but they don't remake Cobra.
I don't
Cobra.
Know what he was thinking. I just don't know what he was thinking when he
actually this is interesting because I respected what his thinking behind that. I thought it was a really cool experiment. I didn't think the movie was very good, obviously, but I took it as an experiment, and it really pointed out for me. You can do it shot by shot. You can time the scenes to the second. But there's something intangible that is conveyed in the original film that is nowhere to be found in Van Sant's film.
Right.
And it's not the mechanics of it. It's not the staging. It's not the timing or the exact shots. There's something else that comes through because this is Hitchcock, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was worthwhile, actually. And Van Sant has actually talked about wanting to remake it again and see, will I be in a different place 10 years from now? How different will this movie look 10 years from now? And that fascinates me. I think he should do it virally. I mean, I don't think it should be a major pushed release in theaters.
Yeah.
But I don't agree with giving him so much grief over that, actually.
Oh no, I mean it's you know, it's come and gone. It's a water under the bridge. I mean, he's done so much. I mean, it's really interesting. It's the films he's done since then that are just astounding, some of them. Paranoid Park, Elephant. I think it's that failure actually allowed him to really cut loose and go back to his roots, I think.
Yeah, and I don't see it as a failure. That was my point.
Right. No, I don't.
I did really have a point.
I'm not gonna nail him. I'm not gonna nail him for that one. But I did. I got to be honest with you, Jamie. I thought it was pointless. I really did.
All right. Well, our first fight.
Oh, we've had plenty of fights. Bring on Aaron. We can have more. Or bring on Nicholas Fargo.
All right, Tim, buddy. Thank you so much. What's your show and when does it air?
My show, it's Silver Blade Pictures. It's so yeah, you know, I mean, go on here, blogtalkradio.com/Silver Blade Pictures, and my next show will probably be, I'll be interviewing one of my best friends who's going to be in one of the movies that I'm directing now called Broken Angel. So,
congratulations.
Great.
Thank you. So, yeah, I'll be, and my first show, I interviewed Sean C. Phillips from the Don and Murph Show on YouTube. So, it's all on there, and there'll be more coming. So.
Okay, great.
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Man.
Thank you.
I appreciate you calling in. I appreciate you listening into the show, too.
Anytime.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, next topic. I'm looking for help. Jerry, you had a whole lot. Actually, Chris, you had something you wanted to discuss tonight.
I did think of something the other day that was just sort of puzzling for me, and I want to know why we don't have any great female directors. Is it because they didn't really start? I mean, you really didn't.
Oh, I disagree with that.
Let him finish his argument, and then we'll get to the second fight.
I know. Okay.
I'm not making an argument. I'm really posing the question because there's directors, there's female directors that I like, but I do think it should be noted that we really didn't get a lot of. I'm talking about American female directors too, by the way.
Okay, well, I'm going with that.
We really didn't get the wave of American female directors until the 80s, for the most part. That's when we really started seeing, you know, female directors in American movies. But so that's been, you know, arguably 20, 25 years now, and we've got some good directors, and we've got some people maybe here recently that have gone on some interesting runs, but we haven't had somebody, you know, we haven't had somebody even approach the territory of, you know, a Scorsese.
Right.
Who's our female Scorsese? Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Where is she? I mean, there are a couple that jump to mind. There are a couple who maybe I thought for a time, you know, maybe somebody like Jane Campion or somebody like Catherine Hardwick or Sofia Coppola. There are female and many others. There are many female directors out there that are making good movies, but there's nobody that really has a singular voice the way that some of the male directors do. There's no one that has a stamp that you can watch her movie without seeing it. And Nancy Myers is another one who I like. And she actually approaches, in my opinion, she approaches what I'm talking about closer than anyone else in terms of having a stamp, in terms of watching a movie and saying, that looks like a Nancy Myers movie.
Right.
I got you.
Right, and also it seems, is it a little sexist to only be able to point out to the female directors that work in the romantic comedy genre? So Jerry, here's his point. Women can't direct, they should just stay at home and cook and clean. Do you disagree?
I disagree with that, and I know that's not his point. The two that come to mind are Lisa Cholodenko, who did High Art and Laurel Canyon, and Allison Anders, who did Gas Food Lodging and Sugartown.
Yeah.
Who's the one who did Stop Loss and Boys Don't Cry?
Kimberly
Pierce.
Yeah.
And
if Spielberg had made Higher Art, if Spielberg had made
High Art,
the Ali Sheedy thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If he had made Boys Don't Cry, would we call him one of the best male directors?
That's a good point. But also the other directors, the woman who did The Slums of Beverly Hills and The Savages, and these are women. Both the last two I've mentioned took a very long time in between features. They did some television work, but maybe they had a hard time coming up with second projects. And who is? Let me look up the director of The Savages.
Catherine Bigelow is another one that jumps.
Yeah,
to mind,
she's got a new. She has a new movie, right?
She's got
Hurt Locker.
Yeah, The Hurt Locker, and The Hurt Locker has actually gotten some really good buzz around it too.
Tamara Jenkins, who did The Savages and The Slums of Beverly Hills, and I guess I see what you're saying. I think that these women have a lot of. They've done phenomenal work. I think of most of the directors, with the exception of Allison Anders, who has four or five films under her belt, the rest only have two. And prolific, but they have, I think with Anders and I think with Cholodenko and Jenkins, they do have like a singular vision that I can pinpoint, and I can see a link in their work. Is it as profound as, you know, like a Scorsese or a Coppola or something like that? No, I don't know. I can't say that right now. There's just not enough work there from each director.
Yeah, it's tough to make that sort of comparison to somebody like Coppola or Scorsese or Spielberg, because we know them now and we know their career. But what you kind of have to do, I think, is think back when Spielberg had been making movies for 10 years, or when Scorsese had been making movies for 10 years,
yeah,
or Coppola, what had he accomplished by that point? Did he already, was he like Tamara Jenkins, who, don't get me wrong, I like Tamara Jenkins,
yeah,
I like Slums of Beverly Hills, and I like Savages even more.
Right.
In fact, I love the Savages.
Mm-hmm.
But that's over 10 years of filmmaking. It's two movies,
mm-hmm,
both of them good, but neither of them... neither of them blowing my skirt up.
Right, right.
You know,
right,
what? But here's the other point, and this is probably the major point. It all comes down to opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They made those great films because they had the opportunity to do so. Are female directors, as a genre unto themselves, are kind of a relatively recent thing, more recent than the filmmakers that have been working since the 60s, you know.
Right, right. Probably since the 80s you started seeing people like Heckerling
and Nora Ephron. And
Nora Ephron, Penny Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
But even those people that we're talking about, Kathryn Bigelow had a big hiatus here recently.
Mm-hmm.
Even before K-19, The Widowmaker, she had a big hiatus, and then after that she had a big hiatus. Same with Amy Heckerling. She makes a movie like every 7 years now. Nora Ephron's got a new movie coming out, but it's been a while since her last one. Penny Marshall, I don't know what the fuck she's doing. She's nowhere.
She was in that was.
She's having her jowls removed.
But the only one I can say that is Singular Vision, and she, it's not fair because, I mean, her father is Francis. It's Sofia Coppola.
Right.
I mean, she's taken her personal, her childhood,
yes,
basically, and turned it into three movies.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And,
yeah,
in fact, I do think that she is probably, out of all of them,
mm-hmm,
obviously she's been nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
And, in fact, did she win the Oscar for Lost in Translation? Maybe. I don't know.
Did she win a screenwriting, maybe, I think? Or?
The screenwriting is what I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's easy. That one she does with Virgin Suicides, with Lost in Translations, with
Marie Antoinette.
She's definitely,
mm-hmm,
got a kind of very unique, that feels like a Sofia Coppola movie,
mm-hmm,
you know, kind of thing going on. So I agree. Maybe she could become what we're talking about. Maybe her next movie, I forget what it is, but she's just announced it recently.
The Chateau Marmont thing, yeah.
Right,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That could be interesting. I think she could develop into it. But I do think that there is some truth to that. It's newer. They haven't been doing it as long, so that's probably, the answer lies somewhere in there. They've only been making movies since the 80s.
Right.
But it does feel like we should be getting one here soon.
Agree with that. I also, it's just interesting, a lot of the directors I mentioned, there is like this long gap in between the first and second film.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity,
so
man.
Explains.
I think it's hard. I think it's probably
it's
difficult.
Hard.
It's still so male-dominated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've broken the acting bubble. And several terrific actresses led the way in that. And of course, if you think of the classic films, you always think of the great females on screen, and
mm-hmm,
how tough and saucy, and how they held their own against the, you know, the Bogarts and so forth.
Right.
But it's yet to really, really break through. I think independent film brought along that promise.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right.
Did, but
you're right.
However, interesting to note, though, I will add this one last little thing, though. As far as female directors, not independent film, the top 20 films directed by females, in that top 20, three of them are Nancy Meyers films,
mm-hmm,
interestingly enough. So she's
right,
someone who, obviously, those are not independent films. She's making Parent Trap,
right,
What Women Want, The Holiday,
right,
things like that. She's got three of those movies, and she actually has a movie coming up here with a huge cast. I forget what it's called, but obviously I'm assuming that it's another romantic comedy, because that does seem to be the genre that she works in.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And actually, The Holiday is one of my all-time favorite romantic comedies. I love that movie. Love
it. I do, too. I do, too. And actually, I like What Women Want. It's a little bit cheesy, but it's a well-made movie.
I actually think Something's Gotta Give is really her best.
Yeah,
the
that's
one
a good
Nicholson
movie.
Nicholson and Keaton.
I have the same problem with every Nancy Meyers movie. They all run 10, 15 minutes too long.
Well, The
Holiday
is definitely
except for The Holiday.
Well, that's just with the 2 hours and 20 minutes, so.
Yeah,
mm-hmm,
yeah. Okay, Jerry, you had some topics that you wanted to discuss.
I had some topics, and we talked, and we actually, you know, talked about one of them, and that was the Wolverine movie, and just some of the other stuff. It's actually kind of dated by today's. I wanted to talk about the Soderbergh movie, The Girlfriend Experience, because this is very interesting because he actually has a real porn star, Sasha Grey, in it. But not only that, he's gonna go back and do what he did with Bubble. It's gonna be released on DVD, on demand. And in theaters when it comes out, and I was just curious.
It already has been.
Oh, it's already on.
It's on demand right now. You could go into your living room and buy it right now.
I might do that this weekend then. But I was just curious what everyone thought about it, and what everyone thinks about his delivery method. This guy is always, even though I don't think everything he does is great, I just love that he is so fascinated by the technique. And he's always exploring. He's always trying new things. And this seems like, once again, he's doing that. And what I love about him, like Richard Linklater or other directors, he can go from the very independent to the very mainstream with no problem, back and forth.
Yeah. And, you know, he's always done that. From the very beginning of his career, that's been a touchstone of his work.
Yeah. I'd like to know what he got offered after Sex Lies videotape came out. Because, you know, I mean, remember when that movie came out, that was the movie that just kicked off the independent film wave.
Yeah.
Not single-handedly, but it was a major player in the independent.
It put Sundance on the map as well to a large extent.
Yes, it did.
Can you imagine, I'm just curious, what sort of movies Soderbergh was offered after that?
And he went and did Kafka, right?
Yeah,
right.
Kafka,
Schizopolis and things like that.
He did
Kafka
and then King of the Hill. What was it? And then the remake
Underneath.
Of Cross. The Underneath, and
Underneath.
Then
Great movie. Yeah, you're right. You know, and he strikes me as a guy that likes to explore, likes to work, likes to be productive. If some of them don't work, so be it.
He just moves on to the next thing.
On to the next film. It was the journey was worthwhile.
Yeah,
absolutely. But strangely enough, most of them do work, to be honest. And some of these things, they just strike you as, oh, it's another Steven Soderbergh, science project type thing. What's he doing? There's nobody in this thing. What is it? But if you sit down and watch it, it's actually really good. Like, even a movie like Bubble, which was just like The Girlfriend Experience, nobody in it that you'd heard of. In fact, that movie didn't even have a porn star who I love.
Bubble is his most low-key movie in a long time.
Right.
It's very ironic because actually Sasha Grey starred in a movie called Bubble Butt 4.
Well, she had it in her contract for The Girlfriend Experience that she could not have sex on screen.
No.
I thought you were about to say she had it in something else.
Yeah, because, I mean, you watch something, like, I don't know if you guys have watched all of Che or not.
No.
Okay, it's, that movie, I don't know whether there's part one and part two, I have issues with it, but I still got to admire, like, his just wanting to do that. I just have always admired that about him. He has a very, you know, we make a big deal about him, but on the mainstream, people really don't. But he is a very fascinating figure.
I've never once, maybe once or twice, gotten the idea that Steven Soderbergh was just shitting something out for the money. For a while there, he was doing that thing where he would go back and forth between independent movie. He would make something like Full Frontal and go make an Oceans movie, and then go back and make Bubble and go back and make another Oceans movie. Maybe those Ocean movies were, it does seem maybe like the second and third Oceans movie where he was just kind of doing it for the money to fund his other stuff. But the other big budget mainstream movies he made, things like Traffic and Aaron Brockovich and especially Out of Sight, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, he's able to jump into that mainstream thing, that big budget thing, and make something that works not only on a cerebral level, but pulls in money at the box office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not so much Out of Sight, but Aaron Brockovich and Traffic.
No, but
certainly.
Out of Sight, you really have to hand it to him because that he is, you know, at that point, he and Clooney are really sort of need each other, and they both find this thing in each other that, you know, he finds this thing in Clooney. All right, let's find out what it is about people. Everyone loves you. Let's show it on screen finally. Let's show that out.
Yeah, because people forget that before Out of Sight, Clooney sucked on film.
Yeah.
I mean, he just sucked. From Dusk
yeah.
Till Dawn was decent, but
he couldn't get
a crap movie.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
He couldn't. He was going to be another David Caruso that just couldn't make that jump from TV. But he, and I think he would probably admit to this, owes his career to Steven Soderbergh.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the first movie they did together was not even a hit, but it was so good that people
yeah.
took notice. Clooney can be awesome on screen. That's what we're looking for.
That is.
Side note, Steven Soderbergh commentaries, best commentaries you can get on DVD. The man always, even if I don't like a Steven Soderbergh movie, I'll watch the commentary because he is one of the most entertaining guys in the world to listen to.
Have you ever read his book, Getting Away With It?
No, I haven't.
It's a great book. It's put out by Faber and Faber. I read it a long time ago, but it's like the commentaries. It's just wonderful. Wonderful insight.
Well, cool. I don't know if you guys saw this. David O. Russell's movie Nailed is just sitting there. He can't get back to it. It's lying dormant. It's not getting
yeah,
finished.
It's unfortunate, you know, because David O. Russell is such a he's one of those guys that we're talking about that
yeah.
has a singular voice. Say what you want about the man, and say what you want about the movies, too. You might not like things like Three Kings. Well, everybody probably likes Three Kings, but you might not like things like I Heart Huckabees or Flirting with Disaster. But he has a singular kind of vision, and when you're watching a movie, it's kind of hard not to admit that I don't think anyone else could have made this like this. Someone
right.
else probably could have made Three Kings, and it would have been forgettable.
Yeah, you're right.
So I'm interested to see what he's going to do with this Fighter movie, although it is interesting to note that the two guys in Hollywood that are known for off-screen rants and off-screen, viral videos, him and Christian Bale, who's going to be in the movie with him, are going to be making a movie together now.
Well, I think it'll be a great fly-on-the-wall opportunity.
These guys need to get together with Funny or Die right away and
yeah.
make a viral video about this because it would be fantastic. It would be huge.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So Jamie, wrong!
We're just doing the McLaughlin group. I had to throw that in.
You're not nuts about David O. Russell, though, are you?
I'm not nuts about David O. Russell. I do like his movies.
Okay.
Well, let me ask. All right. Well, it is always said that if I Heart Huckabees, or if his movies did well, then Nailed would be talking about. Nailed would be in production, would be done. It has nothing to do with his rant. Yeah, his rant is the same
yeah.
that was taught, but it's just because he, his movies just don't make money. That's what it comes down to. There's a great article about all these great young filmmakers on the New York Times a couple of years ago, and the guy said, look, we want them to work. They're just some of them aren't interested in working like nonstop. You know, they don't. We have projects for some of these guys to work in, but when they talked about David O. Russell, said, "Look, his movies just don't make money. We don't. No one's rushing off to."
If they made money, then everything would be water under the bridge.
Yeah,
if Mickey Rourke made blockbuster after blockbuster in the '90s, he wouldn't be a comeback. He'd be employed all this
yeah,
time,
of
even
course.
If he's a
be
terror.
John Travolta.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good point.
It is unfortunate, though, because actually, not to get too far into I Heart Huckabees, but I do think that as a filmmaker, I think that was probably his most personal project, and I think that comes across on screen. It's a tough movie to get into, and it's a tough
yeah.
movie for anyone to sit through. And yeah, I love David O. Russell movies, and I love, thinking movies, and I love movies that challenge you when you're watching them, and I had a hard time watching it the first time.
And by personal, you mean completely fucking indecipherable.
Yeah, because I would think his most personal would be his first film, Spanking the Monkey, was probably his most personal.
Well, that is pretty personal.
Well, leave it to Jamie to bring Nicholas Vargo's hobbies to light.
Spanking the Monkey. I love it how you said, too, you can order the Sasha Grey movie right from your living room. And if you're going to order a Sasha Grey movie, that's exactly where you need to order it from,
that's
I
right.
would think.
Yeah, although I will say that if I'm going to order a Sasha Grey movie, chances are it's probably not going to be the girlfriend experience.
Oh, no, it's not. No, no, no.
speaking of no, I'm sorry. That doesn't work as a segue. Dom DeLuise died.
It's a sad day.
I don't know what that segue would have been from Sasha Grey to Dom DeLuise.
Yeah, I really don't either.
But no, that's very sad. He was 75. He, you know, leaves behind his three sons who are in the business. But, you know, we grew up with him in a lot of great movies, you know, with Burt Reynolds, you know, a lot of funny, you know, silly films and Mel Brooks movies. And, you know, it's a loss.
Yeah, he obviously had a great love for life, yeah. So, Chris, who will be the next to go?
This is good. You're bringing some of that vibe. You bring the Jason show. This is good. I love it.
I do feel like James Garner's just barely holding on.
Uh-oh. Oh, man.
I knew you'd come through.
Well, you know, it's a shame that Dom DeLuise died, but... I like Dom DeLuise, but frankly, he didn't exactly leave behind, you know, a huge amount of films that I'm nuts about.
No, I mean, it's just this comment. It's like, well, I mean, there's a Mel Brooks and some of the stuff he did with Reynolds, but no, after that, I really can't.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything after those. But,
and Jason, Mickey Rooney will never die. He'll always be around to talk about his love of movies.
Are you in the Phantom chat room now?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Phantom chat.
Does anyone here think that Star Trek is going to beat the Wolverine numbers this weekend? Just
yeah.
Curious?
Oh, I think it will beat it by probably Saturday afternoon.
Okay, I just saw here's something interesting. I just saw a J.J. Abrams interviewed on Howard Stern. He said, I'd be happy with $50 million. Howard Stern said, you got to be crazy.
That.
He said, you got to be crazy. And he's downplaying it. J.J. Abrams is downplaying it. He says, look, you got the Trekkies, and then you got people that still say, "Oh, I hate Star Trek." So he's trying to be realistic about it.
Whoa.
But realistically, the movie is going to rock the box office. It's going to be a bigger opening than Wolverine.
Oh, I
the movie
think
it has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
And this is not a very early 100%. This is a couple days before the release. There's a good amount of reviews on it.
Yeah.
And that'll probably – it probably won't stay at 100. You know, there's going to be some people that don't like it. But when a movie is coming out the day after tomorrow and it's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and everyone is saying essentially the same thing, every review you can break down into, hey, listen, I'm not a Star Trek fan. This movie kicks ass.
Yeah.
That's what everyone's saying. So I do think – and I was worried too because my girlfriend doesn't like Star Trek and she was kind of turning her nose up at the preview. But I think what's going to happen is there's going to be enough people that either like Star Trek – or are willing to go along with it and sort of see what he's going to do, what this new cast is going to do, that they're going to pull some of those other people. I know I'm going to be pulling two people to go to the theater this weekend and see it.
Let me read
the
numbers.
Okay. Let's do number predictions. Jerry, what do you
think? The number of the statistics of their Fandango surveyed on 4,000 moviegoers planning to see it, 83% plan to see it opening weekend, 10% plan to show up in the theater in some sort of costume, 48% are fans of J.J. Abrams, 47% are fans of Hero star Zachary Quinto, and 67% are male.
Okay.
So
well,
that's the interesting numbers.
Man, that sure is surprising.
Yeah, of course.
Jerry, what do you think, opening weekend?
I'm going to say 110 million.
Jesus. Okay, Chris.
This is big. I mean, this is a big one.
I honestly, I swear to God.
It's only out for 3 days, dude. Opening weekend is 3 days.
Yeah, I know, but you got tomorrow night's midnight shows that are sold out starting at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
I was going to say 110 also, so I'll go under that. I'll go under. I'll say 105.
Okay.
I think it's going to be huge, too. I do think that it's going to be a big surprise.
Okay.
And IMAX is sold out completely.
Right. I'll say 94.
Okay. Now, what do you think is going to happen with Wolverine? Do you think Wolverine's going to be
Wolverine's going to drop 60%.
I think it's going to be a huge drop too. I think it's going to be a big, big drop, and I think that movie's going to end up making a lot less money than they wanted it to make.
Wolverine will be the people on the date that can't get into Star Trek.
Well, I think everyone will be able to get in to start playing enough screens that everyone.
Is there any counter programming for Star Trek, or is it opening up by itself?
Next day air, but I don't really think that. I think everyone's going to see Star Trek.
Yeah, I think so too.
I guess
the
thinking is that the black people don't like Star Trek. Is that the thinking there?
I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
Oh, look what Jason said. Wolverine can suck my ass. He better hope Nicholas Vargo didn't hear that.
Okay, so next day air, not going to open big.
Well, even counter programming for Wolverine, they had the Ghost of Girlfriend's Past, and that's a, you know, that's a movie that I think probably could have been even more successful. I think it would have made, what, $15 million or something like that.
Right.
I think that movie could have even been more successful in a different slot, like in a different release time. The counter programming is so touchy. It's so weird what movies will be successful counter-programming. Now, the queen, apparently, these days of counter-programming is Meryl Streep, who for the past two summers in a row has had the biggest counter-programming movie, the biggest sleeper of the summer, with Devil Wears Prada, and then also with Mamma Mia last year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, she's got this new movie coming out with the trailer just premiered this past week.
Right.
Julie and Julie, or whatever it's called. Julia and Julie. I got to admit, I think this movie looks awesome. We were talking about female directors earlier. Just from the preview, like, I really want to see it. It looks like a fucking adorable movie.
Yeah.
So if women shouldn't direct and they should stay at home and cook and clean, is it permissible for a woman to make a movie about a cook?
Absolutely not. Darren Aronofsky should have made this movie.
I thought I could reach a compromise.
No. I want – don't get me wrong. I want more female directors. I like these directors that I was talking about, Nancy Myers and Sofia Coppola and Catherine Bigelow. I love me some Catherine Bigelow movies, and I like Catherine Bigelow movies that nobody likes, you know.
I love
movies
Strange
like Strange Days, I was just about to say, and even K-19 The Widowmaker I thought was an excellent movie.
That was a very interesting movie. I like that.
Okay, we played this on the last show, the botched show. I'm not going to play it again, but I wanted you guys' takes on it. The new Coppola film, Tetro, they came out with a trailer. Have you all seen it?
Yeah, I have not seen the trailer yet.
Well, okay.
I watched
the
trailer. The trailer is very interesting looking, but based on what happened with Youth Without Youth, I'm not even going to make any sort of predictions about that movie. I thought Youth Without Youth was going to be his big comeback, and it was going to be this big independent, not big in terms of box office, but interesting movie, and it turned out to be one of the most boring movies made in years.
It was really boring.
It was just unwatchable, almost. It was like a Vincent Gallo movie, actually, and now this movie actually has Vincent Gallo in it, so I don't know. I don't know if I want to make any predictions following Youth Without Youth. But I will say that the preview is actually kind of intriguing. It does look like, and actually you could make the argument that Francis Ford Coppola is very much like what we were talking about with Steven Soderbergh. At certain points in his career, he was kind of an experimental filmmaker. He would go and try different things, even against all odds. He would stick to his guns and say, no, I want to do this. Whether you're talking about how he did The Godfather or how he did The Godfather 2 or going and making, some of the strange choices that he made, he makes choices that other directors probably wouldn't make. So just because his first comeback movie wasn't successful, don't.
Well, I would never rule him out. I'd always rather have him making films than not making anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or making Jack or something like that.
Well, that's true, yeah.
So you've heard about the reviews of the new Terry Gilliam, the final Heath Ledger film?
No. Have reviews come out for that?
Yeah, it's been pretty ecstatic, and they say that obviously Ledger died partway into filming, so they substituted the rest of his part to three additional actors: Colin Farrell,
Johnny Depp.
Yeah, I mean it's quite a.
They say that you don't notice it flows. It could have been conceived that way from the beginning, that it makes perfect sense. And in a Gilliam universe, I'm sure it does. But they say this is the most imaginative, visionary, cohesive film that he's made since Brazil.
I did read a review of this, but unfortunately the review that I read was written by Harry Knowles. So,
Okay.
Now, I don't know, maybe there's other reviews that are saying the same thing, but the one that I read was written by Harry Knowles. I forgot about this. And Harry Knowles, I like Harry Knowles, but Harry Knowles' reviews are a different story.
That's true.
He has a tendency to get a little too excited about some movies that maybe he shouldn't. That said, I love Terry Gilliam, and Jamie, you and I were just talking about Terry Gilliam the other day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What was the point that you made?
In fact, after I was reading that review, I went and looked at one of the back, behind-the-scenes sort of video blogs that Terry Gilliam did for Parnassus, the imaginary duck Parnassus. And it sort of occurred to me as I was watching it and seeing some of the footage from this new movie that Terry Gilliam has been doing for years exactly what Tim Burton has been trying to do for years. Tim Burton, and I've never thought of it before, but Tim Burton seems like sort of the poor man's Terry Gilliam. He's just never been able to capture it. Terry Gilliam can't even capture it anymore for the most part. But
I think Tim Burton captured it early on. He did his own thing. I've often said that Terry Gilliam and Tim Burton were the two great visionary directors of the 90s. And I still believe that. Terry Gilliam found it early, and I think Tim Burton really found it with Beetlejuice, and especially Edward Scissorhands, which I think is his masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ed Wood.
I think
Ed Wood's
Hollow.
The best movie ever made. I think Ed Wood's the first time he actually tried to tell us. Edward Scissorhands too.
Edward Scissorhands and Sleepy Hollow. I mean, the only two movies I'm really not crazy about are the two remakes, The Chocolate Factory and The Planet of the Apes. Those are the only two movies that really.
Coincidentally, The Chocolate Factory, another movie on Sasha Grey's resume.
Thank you so much.
We have a caller here to introduce a caller based on that comment. We have a caller here from a 321 area code. 321, go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Hey, buddy.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, listen, first time listener, guys. I just started my own show on Blog Talk Radio, but I wanted to comment about your Star Trek. You guys think that Star Trek's going to do well?
Yeah.
I think Star Trek's going to do well, but I got to say this because I've been telling everybody this for a long time now. How much shit are they going to put out that's going to be the same old crap? Like, they're remaking Friday the 13th, they're doing Star Trek. How many more movies are they going to put out and expected to do so well? You know what I mean?
Well,
you mean, when are they going to start coming out with movies that they expect to bomb?
When are they going to come out with movies that actually people give a shit about? You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, how many people really are going to go flock and see the new Elm Street when it comes out? I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, how many times are they going to remake a movie?
Let me partially answer your question here.
Yeah,
right now, I do have to say that your timing for this question is bad because it's May. We're right in the middle of May. We're about to get into the summer season, and you're asking for movies that people give a shit about. Now, you ask when those movies are going to come out. They're going to come out in the fall. But asking when they're going to come out in summertime, like in the middle of summer, standing up and going, hey, what's all these crappy movies?
Yeah.
Why isn't anybody making any good movies? That's kind of like walking into a strip club and saying, hey, where's all the ladies with class at? You know, like, what do you mean there are a lot of classy ladies at strip joints? I don't know what strip joints you're going to.
I think Wolverine's already made $85.1 million. I think it's still going to do well. I think Star Trek is going to beat it, but not by much.
Well,
I
and
mean,
how long can it beat it for too? Because again, we're talking about summer, and something
it's
comes out every
Angels
week.
Angels and Demons the next week.
Angels and Demons. A week after that is Terminator.
Oh, yeah.
A week after
and
that.
I think it's going to be great. Yeah, and I've been hearing really good reviews about that movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's put it this way. I think Star Wars is going to be, Star Trek's going to be a big hit because, I mean they are trying to redo it. So, it's going to be sold out, like you guys said. But I just think, when Wolverine, when they first heard about the Wolverine movie, and then, they made it, and then people start bootlegging it and put it on there, I thought it was going to hurt it.
You mentioned Nightmare on Elm Street. Nightmare on Elm Street, a horror movie remake, it is an excuse for teenagers, horror movie fans to go to the theater with their girl and get lucky at the end of the night. Star Trek is an excuse for Trekkies to go to the theater and masturbate. So it's really the same thing.
It's not even a remake. It's like this is like the third or fourth reboot we've seen, like with the James Bond and the Batman. James Bond and Batman, both very successful, really what those series needed to be re-energized. And I think this is what Star Trek needed, quite frankly. And
I'm just looking for
a better person than Abrams.
I'm just looking for an explanation as to why William Shatner has a stick up his ass. And if the movie answers that for me, I'll be fine. What's your name, man?
It's Vinny.
Vinny?
Vinny, you're right.
Is that Movie Talk with Vinny?
What my show's called?
Yes.
Mine's called The Best Damn Movie Show.
Oh, okay. I was way off. I'm sorry. When does it air?
That's a bold statement, yeah.
My show's on 11:30 on Thursday nights. So if you guys wanted to like listen in,
and you said it's called The Second Best Damn Movie Show, right?
Right.
That's by midnight too.
Right, right. It's after Movie Geeks. It's I appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks for calling, man.
We will listen in. I appreciate your call, man.
All right, man. Thanks, guys.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, buddy. Bye, bye. Vinny. All right.
Vinny, baby. Thanks.
Not enough guys named Vinny anymore.
Yeah, you don't really curse your kid with that name anymore, do you?
Yeah, you really
don't. Yeah. It kind of you automatically have a picture of someone in your mind when you hear the name Vinny.
Yeah, John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever.
Do you want to send him a joint or something to calm him down?
He hit my hair. Okay. We're gonna help choose Tom Cruise's next movie. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you the Let me give you the pitches. Motorcade. Here's the pitch. A group of terrorists attack the president's motorcade in L.A. Lynn Wiseman, you know, the underworld guy,
mm-hmm.
is attached to direct.
And Die Hard. Live Free or Die Hard. Yeah.
Right. Okay. That's one. Motorcade. He would play, I guess it's his version of In the Line of Fire, maybe?
Yeah, sounds like it.
Okay. The next one is The Tourist. An Interpol agent, played by Charlize Theron, ropes in an American tourist to help find a bad guy with whom she once had sex with. A foreign director, the one that directed Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day, because that sounds right up that alley, would direct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's
right up that alley, by the way. Another Sasha Gray movie.
Okay, here's the other one. The Matarese Circle. I'm probably
that's the one he should do.
Hang on! Yeah. Don't blow your wad yet.
No,
I'm blowing my wad with Jerry. I know who's supposed to direct that movie. That's the movie he should do.
Another Sasha Gray film. Don't blow your wad yet. Okay.
No, that's Casey Lane.
Here's two. Here's the pitch. It's a little on the outside. Okay. Here's the pitch. Two rival secret agents, one Russian, Cruise, can't be worse than Harrison Ford, one American, Denzel Washington, must team up to hunt an assassin called the Matarese. David Cronenberg would possibly direct. Cruise and Denzel Washington in a Cronenberg film. Okay, here's the last one. The Hardy Men. The Hardy brothers from the famous book series are all grown up. They're played by Ben Stiller and Tom Cruise. And are still up to their old crime-fighting ways. Sean Levy, Night at the Museum guy, will direct. So you guys vote for the Cronenberg? I'm sorry,
don't get me wrong. I love
another
the idea
one.
For the Hardy Men movie. The idea has been around for a long time, and I love that idea. But Ben Stiller's got a lot on his plate right now, so I don't know if that's going to happen.
I'd go with the Matt. It's such a good book, The Matarese Circle. And Cronenberg directing it, that's perfect. That's just pitch perfect.
Now, is that Ludlum? Is that Robert Ludlum?
Yeah, it's a great book. The book and the sequel are both very good. So there's a whole possibility of another Bourne franchise.
Hmm. What was the other one, Jamie?
Wichita, which is, hang on, give me a minute. Wichita, James Mangold. And that's a power name. Isn't Mangold a power name?
He's a good director, I'm curious, but I mean...
Another Sasha Gray title. He would direct the story of a woman unlucky in love who meets a mystery man who turns out to be a secret agent.
Wow. He's got a lot of secret agents.
Yeah, I mean, he's really trying to... I think it's a good... That's interesting, but I really have to go with the Cronenberg one, I think, is just what he needs, because I think Cronenberg can get dig out that character, that dark side in him, just as Michael Mann did in Collateral, and I think that's what we need.
I think the Cronenberg is smart creatively. I think the Hardy Men would be a hoot as well. I think he should do those two and forget about the others, actually.
Yeah.
I think he should do those back-to-back.
I already forgot about the others. So.
Yeah, I don't know what the others are.
The others was his ex-wife's film. Let's. We have a call from a 000 area code. call from
Phantom
hell.
Area code.
Yeah. Caller, you're on the line. I think
hello?
You're
called. It's Satan from hell speaking to us telepathically.
Is anyone there? I mean,
don't scare him off, man.
Yeah, it's bad radio.
Am I on the air?
Telepathic communication.
You're on the air, buddy. What's your name?
Oh, hey, my name is Ben.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, I'm a long-time listener. Is it true you're not having a show next Wednesday?
Is this Jason?
God damn it, O'Brien.
You can't fool me, dude.
Damn it. I tried so hard.
We're not having it.
What happened? Did Tim Price and Nicholas Vargo crank call you earlier?
They did. I
long time listener gave it away right away.
Yeah, really.
Yeah,
I mean,
shut up, Chris. So you wanted to give us a hard time, Jason? Is that why you're calling in?
Yeah, I mean, what am I going to do with my Wednesday night next week? I mean,
well, do what I do next Wednesday. have lots of sex.
Buy a Sasha Grey movie?
Yeah, really. We should have a Sasha Grey tribute show next Wednesday, actually.
Hey guys, if you want to do your own show, I'll program it. You know, everybody has a complaint about me in the chat room, so you guys just go ahead and do a show.
What was that? What did you say about the chat room?
People have been on my case lately.
And I want to address that, actually. You don't mind if I address that, do you?
Okay, go ahead.
Fill me in. I don't have the chat room up. What's the complaint?
No, not just in tonight. Really, I want to talk. It was happened on Sunday when we had the ill-conceived show because of sound issues, and Monday night in Jason's show. And I do have to say this. People are picking on Jamie.
I love how you laugh.
No, but let me say this right now. You fuckers can't pick on them. Only we can, okay? So, Vargo and Price, get the fuck off his back, okay? Or I'll come to your house and with a baseball bat and bash your skulls in, okay? Especially you, Vargo. But only we can abuse our pledges. So only we can abuse Jamie.
God, I find that incredibly sexy somehow, and I'm not homosexual.
Oh God.
You know, and they think that, you know, I'm like, got this thing for you, Jamie. Wow, Jerry, that's a...
I know.
Oh, no, you saw Animal House. Only we can do that to our pledges. You know, what the fuck do these guys think they are? I mean, it's not, you know, fuck them. I mean,
well, thank you for that,
Jerry. What is the complaint? What are people complaining about?
But they're not actually on Jamie's back, they're on his ass. So that you got to get
Just a host of things. It's fine.
It just made no sense. Nick, I think Nicholas was having a bad day and decided to take it out on anyone who was in like a 5 mile range. You know.
Nicholas actually emailed me today and was apologizing for being in a bad mood. He blames himself for setting the chat off last night. So.
Right.
Who knows?
Well, I hope
that's fine.
Tim
has no excuse.
You know what? When you're like a superstar like I am, it comes with the territory.
That's right.
Comes with the territory. Another Sasha Grey movie. It takes place on the frontier.
Yeah.
It's a western.
God. Hysterical. Jason, do you have a topic that you'd like to discuss tonight?
You got a topic? I mean, come on.
Well, I was actually going to call in to promote my own show next Wednesday. I'm going to encourage a call-in show where everybody kind of guesses what's going on with Shelly and Jamie.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I will not be listening.
How long should the show be on for? About 15 minutes or?
Oh, damn, man. That's harsh. You're all sorts of harsh, O'Brien.
That's funny, man. That's funny. Okay. I'll give you props for that.
Yeah.
Thank you, man. No, I'm pumped for Star Trek, man. I'm in complete Star Trek mode right now.
Yeah.
I didn't know it's actually opening tomorrow night. I actually thought it was going to be Friday, but I see it's opening tomorrow night.
Yeah, there's tons of, like, you know, starting at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, every place is showing it.
They're not doing the IMAX thing with it, are they?
Yes, they are.
Oh, yeah.
They are doing the IMAX.
Are they? Good. Yeah, that's right. You said all IMAX are sold out. That's
mm-hmm.
that's terrific.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish we had an IMAX here. I always have to go to Atlanta to go see an IMAX, but I might try to go see it tomorrow night now that I know it's opening tomorrow night.
Chris, I was wondering.
Cut me off.
Man, cut
Shut
Jason
up,
off, man. He called in and everything. Cut him off.
Yeah. Now that Jason's on the line, let's talk to Chris. I was really dying to hear some William Friedkin tonight, dude.
Oh, really?
William Friedkin? Because he invented the internet.
Well, William Friedkin usually doesn't pop up in conversation unless someone makes the claim that they have done something for the first time, you see.
Right.
William Friedkin, he lays low until someone has claimed that they, for instance, used a particular kind of shot for the first time, or they showed something on screen for the first time, with which, of course, William Friedkin has to take umbrage because... I don't know if you know this, but William Friedkin actually did everything ever done on film for the first time.
I was actually the first person to use the Steadicam shot in the movie Fame.
I did not know that.
William, do you wanna say something? Hang on, I'm gonna give him the phone. Hang on.
Okay.
He's always with me.
Yeah, Bill Friedkin here. I'm sorry, someone was making a claim that they used the Steadicam for the first time.
Yes, sir, that was me.
I want to tell you something. I made a film called Sorcerer. It wasn't popular in its day, but it's time has been very kind to Sorcerer. You see, no one had ever used a Steadicam before I made Sorcerer. I was waist high in a swamp in Vietnam filming Sorcerer with a Steadicam. Everyone's like, Bill, what are you doing with the camera there? Why don't we put it on a crane? I'm like, listen, shut your pie hole. I got the Steadicam. I'm doing this for the... I'm making cinema history here. And I said, let me shoot this fucker. And we shot it, and of course no one went and saw it, but no one had ever made a movie like that. I know it was a remake. But no one had ever made a movie quite... No one had ever made a remake before I made Sorcerer. And, of course, I used the Steadicam for the first time.
What were you thinking when you made Jade?
Jade was a movie... See,
I'm sorry. I always cry. I'm laughing so loud at Chris. I'm sorry. He always has that effect on me. Go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry, William. William, go ahead.
It's quite all right, Jamie. I know that Jade... I cry when I watch Jade also. I can't even hear the word Jade without crying. Because no one had ever made a movie with David Caruso where they showed his sensitive side. And by his sensitive side, I mean his balls. No one had ever done that before. I said, David, listen, I'm going to need you to pull out your sack. We're going to need to see it for this shot. I got the Steadicam. We're going to use it. We're going to film it. The movie's going to make no money. No one went to see it. I don't know if you know this or not. But no one had ever made a movie like Jade before.
and hopefully not one like it since.
What about Cruising? Because I'm a big fan of Al Pacino, and you had him honk-tied naked in that movie.
Yeah, what was that like?
Interesting story. 1975, I received anal sex from a man for the first time. Received is probably not the right word.
Probably not the word I would want to use.
No, I suffered. I suffered through anal sex from a man for the first time. And I said, no one has ever done this before, but I got to make a movie about this. Turns out John Holmes already made a movie about it. That was the one time in my career that someone had done something before me.
Well, if you're going to be offended by someone, it's John Holmes, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know. Yeah, John Holmes always came first. And that's what led to Cruising, basically. I said, Al, have you ever done this? He said, no. I said, we got to make a movie about it, and it's going to be the first, well, it's going to be the second time. But no one went and saw it.
Hmm. Interesting. Oh, seems to be a motif in your life. No one went to see it when it came out.
no one went to see anything I've made other than The Exorcist. After that, nothing.
Hmm. Yeah, well, everyone's afraid of something that they haven't seen before. Yeah, I understand that. I can't talk. I've been laughing so loud. You do it to me, dude. All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, William. Good night.
Thank you, William, so much. It was a real honor. I really like Rules of Engagement, by the way.
I'm sorry. I took the phone back from him. He went to go sleep on.
He went to go sleep on
my futon, which no one has ever slept on before.
Well, there you go, another first.
And then no one's going to talk about it afterwards. I pick on Friedkin because I love Friedkin, not his movies. I didn't see any of his movies, but I just love Friedkin. I just love the guy. I don't know what it is. Because he's such a douche. Like,
yeah, but I like this guy. What the gentleman who directed the Wages of Fear said to him when he came, approached him at Con and said, you know, I want to buy the rights to the Wages of Fear to remake Sorcerer. And the director looked at him like, why? Why? Why would you want to remake that?
You know what? Time has actually been very, very kind to Sorcerer. A lot of the movies that were released in that time, a lot of those follow-up movies, whether it's Heaven's Gate or whether it's Sorcerer or whether these movies, and they sort of were panned at the time and didn't make any money, but all three of those movies actually are not bad movies. They're pretty good. They just had unfortunate circumstances.
Yeah, you can't really use, you know, they used to use the term, I mean, everyone used Heaven's Gate as like a euphemism for dud.
Well, they still do, and it's a misnomer, because
if you go back
and watch Heaven's Gate, it's not a bad movie. In fact, it's pretty good.
If you can ever find, like, that there's a print circulating around, like the ultimate director's cut, that's incredible.
I feel the same way about Sorcerer. I love me some Bill Friedkin. Nobody other than Robert Evans, nobody that I love to hear talk about movies more than Friedkin.
True.
Billy Friedkin.
Yeah.
So I had something in mind. I was going to say something. I completely forgot what it was.
Sorry. No one in the world. Ironically, no one had ever done a Bill Friedkin impression before me. So.
You know, that's true. And we opened our show with that 2 years ago.
That is one of the great openings, yeah.
We thought, and I remember you recording that, and you were sanctioned off in this room with a microphone, and the engineer was working it, and all of a sudden you pulled out the Ladies in Love. I wrote that, yeah. It's good stuff.
Is Jason still on the line?
No, he's gone. His phone died. Yeah, his phone, his Skype ran out. So, are there any other impressions you can share with us tonight, Chris?
Unfortunately, not. I had a dandy Vim Vendors impression, but I don't do it anymore.
Oh, okay. Damn, that's a shame.
Because everyone would recognize that one. Yeah. That's like one of those safe impressions, like you're going to impersonate Sir Isaac Newton because nobody can say you don't sound like him. Yeah. I knew Sir Isaac Newton. That's way off. All right, dude. Is there anything else? Jerry, did you have anything else you wanted to discuss tonight?
No, I don't really think we can really top William Friedkin. I'm not even going to attempt that.
I don't think so either, man. Yeah. That was gold. I'm going to replay this until it can no longer. My computer gets sick of it. So,
I'm glad we enjoyed it because I don't think that anyone else.
That's all I'm worried.
Oh,
I'm
wait, the futurist wants Jason to call his Werner Herzog.
It is a dream of mine for us to get Friedkin on the show so we can have Friedkin on Friedkin. If we ever do get Friedkin on the show, I have to interview him as Friedkin. You know what?
That would take a brave soul because you don't know how that'll go. I don't know that he would find that particularly amusing.
Yeah, ever since the Aaron show.
I would absolutely.
Yeah.
I would do it in a heartbeat. And
I mean, Aaron already impersonated Rain Man interviewing Friedkin, so, and he didn't like that either. So.
You're so cold, dear friend.
I love it. No, he did a great job. And he got a big scoop. That was a big show.
That was a big show, yeah.
So, yeah, we'll do that if we ever get Friedkin on the show.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's my contribution, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, all right. Guys, this has been fun.
It has been.
Yeah,
I like
yeah,
this.
Absolutely.
Let's do this more often.
Yeah, we should.
Please, please. That's another Sasha Gray movie, by the way. Let's do this more often.
I don't think she's getting a lot of, you know, we're just giving her just like the greatest legitimate press of her career.
We're giving her a lot of plugs, which
yeah,
incidentally
I
is another
I
movie.
I wasn't even going to go with plugs. I wasn't even going to go there.
Okay. Let's end the show now. Thank you very much, guys. We'll see you back here on Sunday with James Toback and some more great movie talk. Thank you so much, guys. Let's come back Sunday night and have some more fun.
Okay, great.
All right. Hey, you're graduating tomorrow, Chris. Congratulations, buddy.
Congratulations, Chris.
Indeed I am. Thank you very much.
You'll be in that white dress in no time.
Yes, that's right. I'll be
actually in Dark Knight.
Yes, I'm going to wear the Heath Ledger garb from Dark Knight and walk
yeah.
across the stage.
And I appreciate, in your training, I appreciate all those sponge baths, man. That was great.
It's no problem.
There you go.
I know. Whenever Jamie gets into the hospital, it's extra Vaseline with sponge baths.
Yeah, these are images I really did not want before I go to sleep, but so thank you, Chris.
All right, guys. See you next time.
All right, okay.
Bye-bye.